U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Former New York mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg formally enters the Democratic presidential race, and he's already spending big. Does he really have a shot at the Democratic nomination? Plus, a federal judge says Don McGahn, former White House counsel to Donald Trump, must appear before Congress to testify. We'll tell you what this means for impeachment. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and I'm here with two of my brethren, Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Paul.
And Kyle Peterson. Hey, Kyle.
Howdy, howdy.
So let's talk about Michael Bloomberg first. He is worth, I guess, $50 to $55 billion, give or take. I don't think it's ever been formally declared, but he's worth a lot, and he's prepared to spend a lot. He did so as mayor. He's already spending millions in his first advertising broadside of the campaign. He's now formally in. And he has a very interesting strategy, gentlemen. He is not going to compete in the first four contests, not going to compete in Iowa, not going to compete in New Hampshire, not going to compete in South Carolina, not going to compete in Nevada. Going to push all of his focus on Super Tuesday, which is March 3rd this year, which is going to have a huge chunk of delegates across many, many states, including Texas and I believe California. So it is going to be a very significant day. Now, the thing is about that strategy is if it works to win the Democratic nomination, it'll be the first time any candidate has avoided the first contest, gotten in late, first time in modern history and presidential history, and won the nomination. So it's an unusual strategy. On the other hand, Bill, he has the resources to maybe play.
Yeah, it seems like the strategy favored by former New York mayors. Didn't Rudy Giuliani want to skip some of the early
he did.
Primaries?
He said, I'm not going to compete until Florida, and he was out before Florida.
And I think that's exactly the point, right? There's a risk. It makes some sense. We're going to go big. We're going to concentrate on the big day, Super Tuesday. The problem is that Iowa and New Hampshire can change a race. If you actually win a state, people take another look at you, and you can leave the others behind, right? If you forego a bunch of them, that's the danger. I mean, I personally don't think the mayor has a chance. I think what he does have a chance of is being the Chris Christie of this group, of taking someone else out. You know, Christie took out Marco Rubio the last time. He didn't get anywhere himself. And it just depends where he levels his fire in his advertising. Could he say Elizabeth Warren's too expensive for us, you know, that? So he could take himself out without necessarily advancing himself.
To underscore Bill's point about the early contest, the last four Democratic nominees, Kyle, have all won Iowa. So it does help to compete in those early contests. It's not definitive because obviously some people have won Iowa. Tom Harkin won Iowa. He didn't get the nomination. Dick Gephardt won Iowa. He didn't get the nomination. So you can win Iowa and not get the nomination. But it does help. And it does help because it catapults you into New Hampshire, which is a week later. And then that can catapult you down through South Carolina.
Right. The momentum is huge. Especially if you're an underdog candidate, somebody who's not polled in the top tier. If you win Iowa, you win New Hampshire, you get this rush of very positive press coverage. And people start thinking maybe this is a guy we should take seriously, which is the risk of skipping those states. I mean, Bloomberg is a little bit of a different case because, he can drop $500 million on ads if he wants to. But one of the things that makes this such a difficult case to see, at least for me, is the way that Democratic delegates are allocated. If I understand it right, it's a 15% threshold. So some of the delegates are allocated statewide. Some of them are by congressional district. It depends on the state. But if you don't get 15% either statewide or in individual congressional districts, you don't get anything. So if Bloomberg dumps a whole bunch of money into California, for instance, and comes out with a strong 10% showing in the vote, that doesn't help him at all. You have to hit 15% before you get any delegates at all. So it seems to be, he seems to be betting on the idea that Joe Biden at some point, any day now, is going to collapse and he can scoop up that vote.
Ye of little faith, both of you. Let me make the case for Mike Bloomberg's strategy, okay? It goes something like this. Biden is not going to make it. He obviously can't hold himself well in debates. He's going to sink. Pete Buttigieg probably, or Elizabeth Warren, one of those two, or Bernie is going to win Iowa, maybe Mayor Pete. He goes into New Hampshire. Biden will flame out. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are too far left for the electorate to win. The voters, once they stare that in the face, will look for somebody else. Pete Buttigieg could get this rocket ship out of Iowa and New Hampshire, but he goes to South Carolina. He's getting zero support in the polls among African Americans, who are a huge chunk of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina, and then as well as across the Super Tuesday states that include much of the South. That's when Mike Bloomberg swoops in and becomes the alternative as desperate Democrats decide you can't go left. Biden's out. Mayor Pete, too inexperienced, too glib, would get crushed by Donald Trump. And by the way, Mike Bloomberg has a much better mayoral record than poor Pete Buttigieg in South Bend. That's the case.
Well, I'd say the problem with the case is there's always been two Mike Bloombergs, right? One is the part of the guy that I like that was friendly to business, you know, rezoned a lot of New York, gets very, very little credit for that, to make it more competitive and attracting business. He stepped up stop and frisk and really reduced crime, violent crime in the city, saved a lot of lives for that. And he was big on school reform, and his big thing was charter schools. Well, he's already apologized for his efforts on crime. And that charter school thing is a big heresy in the Democratic Party today. So you don't know, you know, which Bloomberg is he going to run as the guy that, you know, wants to take your big gulp soda away? Or is he the guy that says we can do better, you know, on reform? Or is he the guy that just says spending restraint? I'm for a green environment. He is a green guy, but we just can't spend the money that Elizabeth Warren wants to spend on it.
So are you saying that the opposition to him in the Democratic primary will be so significant on ideological grounds on these issues
and plus
that he can't break through?
Didn't Bernie and Elizabeth say there's no room for billionaires in America, much less the Democratic Party nomination, which is getting thick with billionaires now?
All right. Gern didn't persuade me. What about you, Peterson?
And I would just add that to believe the story that you're making, you have to believe that Democratic voters, when they hit that point of decision, if Biden collapses, if they're thinking we can't go with Warren or Sanders, we got to go with somebody who can beat Trump, you got to think that they're going to pass over Kamala Harris, who's polling about 4% nationally. They're going to pass over Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, you know, all of these younger, more diverse female minority candidates who are in the Senate, who haven't been out of politics for years and years and years.
But some of those
over them and turn to Mike Bloomberg.
Some of those people are going to be out after Iowa and New Hampshire, Kyle. If Amy Klobuchar doesn't do at least top three in Iowa, I think she's in the neighbor from a neighboring state. I think she's got to drop out.
That's a fair point, but it depends on how late Biden collapses.
Right.
I mean, that's part of the issue too. And if he collapses, I mean, you gotta admit also that people have been talking about how he keeps putting his foot in his mouth, and yet he's chugging along at, you know, he's never been below 25% in the Real Clear Politics average through this whole campaign.
Yeah, that's true. And if the whole Bloomberg rationale goes away if Biden
stays
and right. does well, then I think it there's no rationale.
And Biden just took a big hit. There's a Politico story talking about Barack Obama meeting with some of the candidates and what he's telling them. And supposedly he said that, you know, in 2008, he had an intimate bond with the people in Iowa. And that he said it's gone today. He no longer has it. And then he supposedly added, and you know who really doesn't have it? Joe Biden.
So this is Politico, so it's in the realm of might be true.
Might not be true. Might
be
true. But certainly Barack Obama has not come to Joe Biden's aid so far. But I think this just adds to the view that he's either too old, he can't make it, doesn't have the support. So that's what I think everyone's waiting to see if Joe Biden collapses. Yeah. Well, I just think if they collapse, wouldn't it be more likely to go with Amy Klobuchar than Mike Bloomberg? Even though I think a Bloomberg-Trump debate in the general would be really fascinating.
Well, you might be right about Klobuchar. I'm just saying that she hasn't grabbed anybody's attention so far. I think she's, from my point of view, as a Democratic candidate, she has a lot to appealing about her. I think she could actually be pretty effective against Trump. But it so far, it just hasn't caught on. All right. We're talking about Mike Bloomberg entering the Democratic presidential campaign. And we also want to get to impeachment and the latest court ruling. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Bill McGurn. And just to continue a little bit more with Michael Bloomberg's candidacy, it is fascinating to see the Democratic response to him, which is essentially boils down to we don't want any more billionaires in this race. We already got Tom Steyer, and you can't buy this election. You can't buy this election. You can't buy this presidency. You shouldn't be able to buy the presidency. But you know what they're trapped by, Kyle? And this is, I think, one of the ironies here, is Democrats have always said we need limits on individual campaign contributions. We need limits on what you can spend on politics. Well, so that leaves all these other candidates out there trying to get small dollar donors, $25 here, $2,600 there if you're Joe Biden and some others from more well-to-do donors who can afford the maximum limit on individual contributions. But Mike Bloomberg, there's no limit on what Mike Bloomberg can spend on himself. And I can tell you, what did he spend to become mayor of New York three times? Probably more than $200 million easily. So what he's willing to spend, if he has any kind of traction in the presidential nominating process, easily could spend over $1 billion before the general election.
And that could make a difference. I mean, TV advertising works. There's a reason that campaigns do it. One of
And organizing,
right? People on the ground is huge. One of the small ironies of this, which I think is a little bit funny, is the Democratic National Committee, as they're setting up qualifying requirements for the debates, has put in a donor threshold. So to get on the December debate stage, every candidate has to have 200,000 unique donors. And one of the ironies here is that Bloomberg is saying he's not going to fundraise. He's not going to raise money from individuals because he can just take it out of his own pocket, which essentially means that he's not going to be able to get on the next debate stage unless he can prevail on the Democratic National Committee to change the rules for the January-February debates, or he decides he's going to sell hats or something and try to hit the threshold that way.
So that assumes that the debates are going to be still significant. But remember the other billionaire who ran recently, Bill? There was a gentleman on the Republican side named Donald Trump, and he turned his wealth into a virtue, political virtue, or tried to. He said, I can't be bought. Unlike these other people, right. I can't be bought. Could Bloomberg turn the tables that way too?
I think he could, and I think he'd be tough in debate because he was the mayor of the biggest city for 12 years, and overall, he did a pretty good job. Again, a lot of nanny state stuff I didn't like, but I remember about a year before he was leaving, and I was speaking to the editor of the New York Post, Cal Allen, about complaining about like his big gulp soda grab or something, and he said, "You say that now, but when he's gone, you're going to be on your knees wishing he was back." Given the alternative, so he has a pretty good record. I think he can hold his own, but the other thing is New Yorkers don't travel well outside of New York. You know, Rudy Giuliani was pretty popular, America's mayor, but, you know, he didn't go anywhere, anyone else. Right. You're from the Midwest. I went to school in the Midwest. So let me tell you, they don't look at New York humor and New York more than, and no one's accused Mayor Bloomberg of being a modest, retiring kind of man.
Not only that, but also he can come off as brusque and condescending.
But he would shake up a debate in the way that Trump shook up the Republican Party. If he could get on stage, he would shake up a debate. I don't know in which direction, but he would certainly mix it up.
All right, we shall see. That'll be fun. Let's talk about the ruling, a significant ruling in the district court for the District of Columbia. Judge Ketanji Jackson, Barack Obama appointee, federal district court judge, said that Don McGahn, the former general counsel to Donald Trump, will have to testify, honor a subpoena by the House Judiciary Committee to testify regarding his relations to the president on the float out of the Robert Mueller investigation, Kyle, his relations on a certain obstruction of justice questions they want to ask him. Now, the Justice Department has already indicated it will appeal that ruling and is seeking a stay of that lower court ruling. And my guess would be that the appellate court will issue that stay. And if the appellate court doesn't, then the Supreme Court probably will issue the stay, because this question of whether or not aides to the president, intimate aides to the president, and the general counsel in the White House is an intimate aide, is a question of some constitutional moment in the separation of powers. And this judge's ruling was so sweeping. I read all 120-some pages of the ruling, and it is so sweeping in its declaration of that there is really no such thing as advisor to the president immunity, that I think this deserves a larger appellate hearing. But what do you make of the impact on impeachment?
Well, on one hand, as you say, it's a sweeping ruling, and it raises some serious separation of powers issues if Congress can compel, you know, somebody who's the president's general counsel to come in and tell everything that he's telling his boss, all the advice he's giving, all
the conversations. Or the advice that his boss is giving.
Sure. All the conversations taking place inside the Oval Office. There's a similar case pending over a deputy at the National Security Council. So we're going to get that ruling or that hearing next month. There's some other issues there, because that's a national security setting. So there may be some other immunities that can be claimed there. So on one hand, that seems significant. But on the other hand, this is going to get appealed to the D.C. Circuit. It may get appealed to the Supreme Court, and we may get if it doesn't become moot before it gets there, we may get a real landmark ruling on the separation of powers here. But as for the immediate effect on impeachment, Democrats seem unlikely to wait for all of that to play out. So we may have months and months of it winding its way up the court system after President Trump is already impeached.
The timeline is crucial here, Bill, because the Judiciary Committee wants, and the Democrats in the House want to move on an impeachment articles before the end of the year. And probably this won't be settled by them. And they are considering, however, an article of impeachment to be related to obstruction of justice flowing out of the Robert Mueller investigation. That hasn't been the subject of the hearings in the Senate Intelligence Committee over the last 2 weeks, but this could be an add-on article.
Right. Well, it sort of gets back to the tension by having this timeline where they want it, you know, they want the hanging done by Christmas. They're in a box because any court litigation takes time. So the question is, are you after the truth? Do you want to hear from the president's people what went on, or do you just want to get this done? And I think this jams it up a little, because it will be stayed. And I could see it going to the Supreme Court, because I have a hard time thinking the court's going to let this kind of sweeping ruling. They may keep parts of it intact, but I have a hard time feeling they're going to defer to a lower court on such an important thing with so many consequences. Again, they might may agree with part of the ruling and so forth. So I think, you know, the courts are not the Democrats' friend in terms of the timeline now. It would be interesting, because if they just said, we're going to get to the bottom of this no matter how long it takes, you know, they might end up getting a few of the President Trump's people to have to tell them what they know.
Sure. I think that that's entirely possible. The Supreme Court could say that Don McGahn, as a former general counsel, right, needs to testify, although he can cabin certain some of his right conversations with the president. That could be how the Supreme Court came
she
out.
She even allowed room for that, right?
It's for like certain information. Right. Yeah. That would be subject to classification right or national security. But at one point, she basically says that the claim of absolute advisory immunity does not exist. And she dismissed Office of Legal Counsel opinions in the executive branch, right, which is the kind of the separation of power brain center right of the Justice Department. And there was an opinion going back to William Rehnquist when he ran the Office of Legal Counsel in 1971 on advisory immunity. And she basically said, well, those are merely aspirational assertions unrelated to any previous judicial ruling or, she said, any constitutional basis. So she is she really just got back on her heels and took a big swing at the executive
well, she's right
branch
they,
power.
They are aspirational rulings, but each branch gets to decide. I mean, the founders thought that each branch would jealously guard its own powers. And there's some overlap where it's not clear, right? And each side asserts itself. And then the hope is that they come to an accommodation, right? I don't see a lot of that decision standing at the end because I think it argues against an accommodation and it seems to take one side in a separation of powers debate.
And the implication is if her interpretation of that claim of immunity would stand, Kyle, is that if you're an intimate aide of the president, we're not talking about 300 advisors, we're talking about maybe a half dozen or so, the general counsel, chief of staff, really the main advisors. If you can be called to Capitol Hill at any time, then the advice and the quality of advice you'll give to the president and the ability of the president to have unrestrained discussions with you let's say I'm the president, I go, Kyle, I really have doubts about this Syria policy. And you go, no, Mr. President. Well, let me give you another example. I really want Rudy Giuliani to go to Ukraine and see if they can investigate Joe Biden. And I'm the chief of staff. And I say, that's a terrible idea, sir. And then if Gerald Nadler can call you and say, so what did the president tell you about Ukraine? You're going to have very different conversations in the Oval Office, and the president and the advisors to the president then not only work for the president, in a sense, they work for Congress. And that's a very, very dangerous proposition for the separation of powers.
It does seem like a real risk that it would chill free, open debate within the West Wing, within the White House on these policy issues. And particularly because if you are a smart, circumspect, legally trained person going into the White House to work in that kind of environment, if you know that you can be called, you're going to be a little bit quieter. You're going to keep your head down. You're going to maybe preserve your ability to say, "Well, I didn't bring that up to the president precisely, to the Congress when you're called," as opposed to having a real free exchange of discussion, which is what the president needs when he's making these decisions about all kinds of really tricky subjects.
All right. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We're going to take a break here over the Thanksgiving holiday and wishing everybody a happy Thanksgiving with family and friends. And we'll be back next week with more editions of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.